We're not very good at songs, John says. Let's tell stories then, Chris says. He thinks for a while. Do you know any good ghost stories? All the kids in our cabin used to tell ghost stories at night. You tell us some, John says. And he does. They are kind of fun to hear. Some of them I haven't heard since I was his age. I tell him so, and Chris wants to hear some of mine. But I can't remember any. After a while, he says, Do you believe in ghosts? No, I say. Why not? Because they are unscientific. The way I say this makes John smile. They contain no matter, I continue, and have no energy, and therefore, according to the laws of science, do not exist except in people's minds. The whiskey, the fatigue, and the wind in the trees start mixing in my mind. Of course, I add, the laws of science contain no matter, and have no energy either, and therefore do not exist except in people's minds. It's best to be completely scientific about the whole thing, and refuse to believe in either ghosts or the laws of science. That way you're safe. That doesn't leave you very much to believe in, but that's scientific too. I don't know what you're talking about, Chris says. I'm being kind of facetious. Chris gets frustrated when I talk like this, but I don't think it hurts him. One of the kids at YMCA camp says he believes in ghosts. He was just spoofing you. No, he wasn't. He said that when people haven't been buried right, their ghosts came back to haunt people. He really believes in that. He was just spoofing you, I repeat. What's his name? Sylvia says. Tom Whitebear. John and I exchange looks, suddenly recognizing the same thing. Oh, Indian, he says. I laugh. I guess I'm going to have to take that back a little, I say. I was thinking of European ghosts.
What's the difference?
John roars with laughter.
He's got you, he says.
I think a little and say, Well, Indians sometimes have a different way of looking at things, which I'm not saying is completely wrong. Science isn't part of the Indian tradition.
Tom Whitebear said his mother and dad told him not to believe all that stuff, but he said his grandmother whispered it was true anyway, so he believes it.
He looks at me pleadingly. He really does want to know things sometimes. Being facetious is not being a very good father. Sure, I say, reversing myself. I believe in ghosts, too. Now John and Sylvia look at me peculiarly. I see I'm not going to get out of this one easily and brace myself for a long explanation. It's completely natural, I say, to think of Europeans who believed in ghosts or Indians who believed in ghosts as ignorant. The scientific point of view has wiped out every other view to a point where they all seem primitive, so that if a person today talks about ghosts or spirits, he is considered ignorant or maybe nutty. It's just all but completely impossible to imagine a world where ghosts can actually exist. John nods affirmatively, and I continue. My own opinion is that the intellect of modern man isn't that superior. IQs aren't that much different. Those Indians and medieval men were just as intelligent as we are, but the context in which they thought was completely different. Within that context of thought, ghosts and spirits are quite as real as atoms, particles, photons, and quants are to a modern man. In that sense, I believe in ghosts. Modern man has his ghosts and spirits too, you know.
What?
Oh, the laws of physics and of logic, the number system, the principle of algebraic substitution. These are ghosts. We just believe in them so thoroughly they seem real. They seem real to me, John says.
I don't get it, says Chris.
So I go on. For example, it seems completely natural to presume that gravitation and the law of gravitation existed before Isaac Newton. It would sound nutty to think that until the 17th century, there was no gravity.
Of course.
So, when did this law start? Has it always existed? John is frowning, wondering what I am getting at. What I'm driving at, I say, is the notion that before the beginning of the Earth, before the sun and the stars were formed, before the primal generation of anything, the law of gravity existed.
Sure.
Sitting there, having no mass of its own, no energy of its own, not in anyone's mind because there wasn't anyone, not in space because there was no space either, not anywhere,
this law of gravity still existed?
Now John seems not so sure.
If that law of gravity existed, I say, I honestly don't know what a thing has to do to be non-existent. It seems to me that law of gravity has passed every test of non-existence there is. You cannot think of a single attribute of non-existence that that law of gravity didn't have, or a single scientific attribute of existence it did have. And yet it is still common sense to believe that it existed.
John says, I guess I'd have to think about it.
Well, I predict that if you think about it long enough, you'll find yourself going round and round and round and round until you finally reach only one possible, rational, intelligent conclusion. The law of gravity, and gravity itself, did not exist before Isaac Newton. No other conclusion makes sense.
And what that means, I say before he can interrupt, and what that means is that that law of gravity exists nowhere except in people's heads. It's a ghost. We are all of us very arrogant and conceited about running down other people's ghosts, but just as ignorant and barbaric and superstitious about our own.
Why does everybody believe in the law of gravity, then?
Mass hypnosis, in a very orthodox form known as education.
You mean the teacher is hypnotizing the kids into believing the law of gravity?
Sure. That's absurd.
You've heard of the importance of eye contact in the classroom. Every educationist emphasizes it. No educationist explains it.
John shakes his head and pours me another drink. He puts his hand over his mouth and in a mock aside says to Sylvia, You know, most of the time he seems like such a normal guy.
I counter, That's the first normal thing I've said in weeks. The rest of the time I'm feigning 20th century lunacy just like you are, so as not to draw attention to myself.
But I'll repeat it for you, I say. We believe the disembodied words of Sir Isaac Newton were sitting in the middle of nowhere billions of years before he was born, and that magically he discovered these words. They were always there, even when they applied to nothing. Gradually, the world came into being, and then they applied to it. In fact, those words themselves were what formed the world.
That, John, is ridiculous.
The problem, the contradiction the scientists are stuck with, is that of mind. Mind has no matter or energy, but they can't escape its predominance over everything they do. Logic exists in the mind. Numbers exist only in the mind. I don't get upset when scientists say that ghosts exist in the mind. It's that only that gets me. Science is only in your mind, too. It's just that that doesn't make it bad. Or ghosts, either.
They are just looking at me, so I continue.
Laws of nature are human inventions, like ghosts. Laws of logic, of mathematics, are also human inventions, like ghosts. The whole blessed thing is a human invention, including the idea that it isn't a human invention. The world has no existence whatsoever outside the human imagination. It's all a ghost, and in antiquity was so recognized as a ghost. The whole blessed world we live in, it's run by ghosts. We see what we see because these ghosts show it to us. Ghosts of Moses and Christ and the Buddha and Plato and Descartes and Rousseau and Jefferson and Lincoln. On and on and on. Isaac Newton is a very good ghost, one of the best. Your common sense is nothing more than the voices of thousands and thousands of these ghosts from the past. Ghosts and more ghosts. Ghosts trying to find their place among the living.
John looks too much in thought to speak, but Sylvia is excited.
Where do you get all these ideas? She asks.
I'm about to answer them, but then do not. I have a feeling of having already pushed it to the limit, maybe beyond, and it is time to drop it. After a while, John says, It'll be good to see the mountains again.
Yes, it will, I agree.
One last drink to that. We finish it and are off to our rooms. I see that Chris brushes his teeth and let him get by with a promise that he'll shower in the morning. I pull seniority and take the bed by the window. After the lights are out, he says,
Now tell me a ghost story.
I just did, out there.
I mean a real ghost story.
That was the realest ghost story you'll ever hear. You know what I mean, the other kind.
I try to think of some conventional ones.
I used to know so many of them when I was a kid, Chris, but they're all forgotten, I say.
It's time to go to sleep. We've all got to get up early tomorrow. Except for the wind through the screens of the motel window, it is quiet. The thought of all that wind sweeping toward us across the open fields of the prairie is a tranquil one, and I feel lulled by it. The wind rises and then falls, then rises and sighs, then falls again, from so many miles away. I'm half asleep. Chris, I say, I knew a fellow once who spent all his whole life doing nothing but hunting for a ghost, and it was just a waste of time, so go to sleep. I realize my mistake too late.
Did he find him?
Yes, he found him, Chris. I keep wishing Chris would just listen to the wind and not ask questions.
What did he do then?
He thrashed him good.
Then what?
Then he became a ghost himself. Somehow I had the thought this was going to put Chris to sleep, but it's not, and it's just waking me up.
What is his name?
No one you know.
But what is it?
It doesn't matter.
Well, what is it anyway?
His name, Chris, since it doesn't matter, is Phaedrus. It's not a name you know.
Did you see him on the motorcycle in the storm?
What makes you say that?
Sylvia said she thought you saw a ghost.
That's just an expression.
Dad?
This had better be the last question, Chris, or I'm going to become angry.
I was just going to say you sure don't talk like anyone else.
Yes, Chris, I know that, I say. It's a problem. Now go to sleep.
Good night, Dad.
Good night. A half hour later, he is breathing sleepfully, and the wind is still strong as ever, and I am wide awake. There, out the window in the dark, this cold wind crossing the road into the trees, the leaves shimmering flecks of moonlight. There is no question about it. Phaedrus saw all of this. What he was doing here, I have no idea. Why he came this way, I will probably never know. But he has been here, steered us onto this strange road, has been with us all along. There is no escape. I wish I could say that I don't know why he is here, but I'm afraid I must now confess that I do. The ideas, the things I was saying about science and ghosts, and even that idea this afternoon about caring and technology, they are not my own. I haven't really had a new idea in years. They are stolen from him, and he has been watching, and that is why he is here. With that confession, I hope he will now allow me some sleep. Poor Chris. Do you know any ghost stories? He asked. I could have told him one, but even the thought of that is frightening. I really must go to sleep. Chapter 4. Every Chautauqua should have a list somewhere of valuable things to remember that can be kept in some safe place for times of future need and inspiration. Details. And now, while the others are still snoring away, wasting this beautiful morning sunlight, well, to sort of fill the time, what I have here is my list of valuable things to take on your next motorcycle trip across the Dakotas. I have been awake since dawn. Chris is still sound asleep in the other bed. I started to roll over for more sleep, but heard a rooster crowing, and then became aware we are on vacation, and there is no point in sleeping. I can hear John right through the hotel partition, sawing wood in there, unless it's Sylvia. No, that's too loud. Damn chainsaw, it sounds like. I got so tired of forgetting things on trips like this, I made this up and store it in a file at home to check off when I am ready to go. Most of the items are commonplace and need no comment. Some of them are peculiar to motorcycling and need some comment. Some of them are just plain peculiar and need a lot of comment. The list is divided into four parts: clothing, personal stuff, cooking and camping gear, and motorcycle stuff. The first part, clothing, is simple. 1. Two changes of underwear. 2. Long underwear. 3. One change of shirt and pants for each of us. I use Army surplus fatigues. They're cheap, tough, and don't show dirt. I had an item called dress clothes at first, but John penciled tux after this item. I was just thinking of something you might want to wear outside a filling station. 4, one sweater and jacket each. 5, gloves. Unlined leather gloves are best because they prevent sunburn, absorb sweat, and keep your hands cool. When you're going for an hour or two, little things like this aren't important. But when you're going all day long, day after day, they become plenty important. 6, cycle boots. 7, rain gear. 8, helmet and sunshade. 9, bubble. This gives me claustrophobia, so I use it only in the rain, which otherwise, at high speed, stings your face like needles. 10, goggles. I don't like windshields because they also close you in. These are some British laminated plate glass goggles that work fine. The wind gets behind sunglasses. Plastic goggles get scratched up and distort vision. The next list is personal stuff. Combs, billfold, pocket knife, memoranda booklet, pen, cigarettes and matches, flashlight, soap and plastic soap container, toothbrushes and toothpaste, scissors, APCs for headaches, insect repellent, deodorant. After a hot day on a cycle, your best friends don't need to tell you. Sunburn lotion. On a cycle, you don't notice sunburn until you stop, and then it's too late. Put it on early. Band-aids. Toilet paper. Washcloth. This can go into a plastic box to keep other stuff from getting damp. Towel. Books. I don't know of any other cyclist who takes books with him. They take a lot of space, but I have 3 of them here anyway, with some loose sheets of paper in them for writing. These are, 1, the shop manual for this cycle, 2, a general troubleshooting guide containing all the technical information I can never keep in my head. This is Chilton's Motorcycle Troubleshooting Guide, written by O.C. Rich and sold by Sears Roebuck. 3, a copy of Thoreau's Walden, which Chris has never heard and which can be read 100 times without exhaustion. I try always to pick a book far over his head and read it as a basis for questions and answers, rather than without interruption. I read a sentence or two, wait for him to come up with his usual barrage of questions, answer them, then read another sentence or two. Classics read well this way. They must be written this way. Sometimes we have spent a whole evening reading and talking and discovered we have only covered 2 or 3 pages. It's a form of reading done a century ago, when chautauquas were popular. Unless you've tried it, you can't imagine how pleasant it is to do it this way. I see Chris is sleeping over there, completely relaxed, none of his normal tension. I guess I won't wake him up yet. Camping equipment includes 1, 2 sleeping bags, 2, 2 ponchos and 1 ground cloth. These convert into a tent and also protect the luggage from rain while you're traveling. 3, rope. 4, U.S. geodetic survey maps of an area where we hope to do some hiking. 5, machete. 6, compass. 7, canteen. I couldn't find this anywhere when we left. I think the kids must have lost it somewhere. 8, 2 army surplus mess kits with knife, fork, and spoon. 9, a collapsible Sterno stove with 1 medium-sized can of Sterno. This is an experimental purchase. I haven't used it yet. When it rains, or when you're above the timberline, firewood is a problem. 10, some aluminum screw-top tins for lard, salt, butter, flour, sugar. A mountaineering supply house sold us these years ago. 11, Brillo for cleaning. 12, 2 aluminum frame backpacks. Motorcycle stuff. A standard toolkit comes with the cycle and is stored under the seat. This is supplemented with the following. A large adjustable open-end wrench, a machinist's hammer, a cold chisel, a taper punch, a pair of tire irons, a tire patching kit, a bicycle pump, a can of molybdenum disulfide spray for the chain. This has tremendous penetrating ability into the inside of each roller, where it really counts, and the lubricating superiority of molybdenite disulfide is well known. Once it is dried off, however, it ought to be supplemented with good old SAE 30 engine oil. Impact driver, a point file, feeler gauge, test lamp. Spare parts include plugs, throttle, clutch, and brake cables, points, fuses, headlight and taillight bulbs, chain coupling link with keeper, cotter pins, baling wire. Spare chain. This is just an old one that was about shot when I replaced it. Enough to get to a cycle shop if the present one goes.
And that's about it.
No shoelaces. It would probably be normal about this time to wonder what sort of U-Haul trailer all this is in. But it's not as bulky, really, as it sounds. I'm afraid these other characters will sleep all day if I let them. The sky outside is sparkling and clear. It's a shame to waste it like this. I finally go over and give Chris a shake. His eyes pop open, then he sits bolt upright, uncomprehending. Shower time, I say. I go outside. The air is invigorating. In fact, Christ, it is cold out. I pound on the Sutherland's door. Yeah, comes John's sleepy voice through the door. Yeah. It feels like autumn. The cycles are wet with dew. No rain today. But cold. It must be in the 40s. While waiting, I check the engine oil level and tires and bolts and chain tension. A little slack there, and I get out the toolkit and tighten it up. I'm really getting anxious to get going. I see that Chris dresses warmly, and we are packed and on the road, and it is definitely cold. Within minutes, all the heat of the warm clothing is drained out by the wind, and I am shivering with big shivers, bracing. It ought to warm up as soon as the sun gets higher in the sky. About half an hour of this, and we'll be in Ellendale for breakfast. We should cover a lot of miles today on these straight roads. If it weren't so damn cold, this would be just gorgeous riding. Low-angled dawn sun striking what looks almost like frost covering these fields. But I guess it's just dew, sparkling and kind of misty. Dawn shadows everywhere make it look less flat than yesterday. All to ourselves. Nobody's even up yet, it looks like. My watch says 6:30. The old glove above it looks like it's got frost on it, but I guess it's just residues from the soaking last night. Good old beat-up gloves. They are so stiff now from the cold I can hardly straighten my hand out. I talked yesterday about caring. I care about these moldy old riding gloves. I smile at them flying through the breeze beside me because they have been there for so many years and are so old and so tired and so rotten. There is something kind of humorous about them. They have become filled with oil and sweat and dirt and spattered bugs. And now when I set them down flat on a table, even when they are not cold, they won't stay flat. They've got a memory of their own. They cost only $3 and have been restitched so many times it is getting impossible to repair them. Yet I take a lot of time and pains to do it anyway because I can't imagine any new pair taking their place. This is impractical, but practicality isn't the whole thing with gloves or with anything else. The machine itself receives some of the same feelings. With over 27,000 on it, it's getting to be something of a high miler, an old-timer, although there are plenty of older ones running. But over the miles, and I think most cyclists will agree with this, you pick up certain feelings about an individual machine that are unique for that one individual machine and no other. A friend who owns a cycle of the same make, model, and even same year brought it over for repair, and when I test-rode it afterward, it was hard to believe it had come from the same factory years ago. You could see that long ago it had settled into its own kind of feel and ride and sound. Completely different from mine. No worse, but different. I suppose you could call that a personality. Each machine has its own unique personality, which probably could be defined as the intuitive sum total of everything you know and feel about it. This personality constantly changes, usually for the worse, but sometimes surprisingly for the better. And it is this personality that is the real object of motorcycle maintenance. The new ones start out as good-looking strangers and, depending on how they are treated, degenerate rapidly into bad-acting grouches or even cripples, or else turn into healthy, good-natured, long-lasting friends. This one, despite the murderous treatment it got at the hands of those alleged mechanics, seems to have recovered and has been requiring fewer and fewer repairs as time goes on. There it is, Ellendale. A water tower, groves of trees and buildings among them in the morning sunlight. I've just given in to the shivering, which has been almost continuous the whole trip. The watch says 7:15. A few minutes later, we park by some old brick buildings. I turn to John and Sylvia, who have pulled up behind us. That was cold, I say. They just stare at me fish-eyed. Bracing, what? I say. No answer. I wait until they are completely off, then see that John is trying to untie all their luggage. He is having trouble with the knot. He gives up, and we all move toward the restaurant. I try again. I'm walking backward in front of them toward the restaurant, feeling a little manic from the ride, wringing my hands and laughing. Sylvia, speak to me! Not a smile. I guess they really were cold. They order breakfast without looking up.
Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 2, Side 1. They order breakfast without looking up. Breakfast ends, and I say finally, "What next?" John says slowly and deliberately, "We're not leaving here until it warms up." He has a sheriff at sundown tone in his voice, which I suppose makes it final. So John and Sylvia and Chris sit and stay warm in the lobby of the hotel adjoining the restaurant, while I go out for a walk. I guess they're kind of mad at me for getting them up so early to ride through that kind of stuff. When you're stuck together like this, I figure small differences in temperament are bound to show up. I remember, now that I think of it, I've never been cycling with them before 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, although for me, dawn and early morning is always the greatest time for riding. The town is clean and fresh and unlike the one we woke up in this morning. Some people are on the street and are opening stores and saying good morning and talking and commenting about how cold it is. 2 thermometers on the shady side of the street read 42 and 46 degrees. 1 in the sun reads 65 degrees. After a few blocks, the main street goes into 2 hard, muddy tracks into a field, past a Quonset hut full of farm machinery and repair tools, and then ends in a field. A man standing in the field is looking at me suspiciously, wondering what I am doing, probably, as I look into the Quonset hut. I return down the street, find a chilly bench, and stare at the motorcycle. Nothing to do. It was cold, all right, but not that cold. How did John and Sylvia ever get through Minnesota winters, I wonder? There's kind of a glaring inconsistency here that's almost too obvious to dwell on. If they can't stand physical discomfort, and they can't stand technology, they've got a little compromising to do. They depend on technology and condemn it at the same time. I'm sure they know that, and that just contributes to their dislike of the whole situation. They're not presenting a logical thesis. They're just reporting how it is. But 3 farmers are coming into town now, rounding the corner in that brand-new pickup truck. I'll bet with them it's just the other way around. They're going to show off that truck and their tractor and that new washing machine, and they'll have the tools to fix them if they go wrong, and know how to use the tools. They value technology, and they're the ones who need it the least. If all technology stopped tomorrow, these people would know how to make out. It would be rough, but they'd survive. John and Sylvia and Chris and I would be dead in a week. This condemnation of technology is ingratitude, that's what it is. Blind alley, though. If someone's ungrateful and you tell him he's ungrateful, okay, you've called him a name. You haven't solved anything. 1/2 hour later, the thermometer by the hotel reads 53 degrees. Inside the empty main dining room of the hotel, I find them looking restless. They seem, by their expressions, to be in a better mood, though. And John says optimistically, "I'm going to put on everything I own, and then we'll make it all right." He goes out to the cycles, and when he comes back, says, "I sure hate to unpack all that stuff, but I don't want another ride like that last one." He says it is freezing in the men's room, and since there is no one else in the dining room, he crosses behind a table back from where we are sitting, and I am sitting at the table, talking to Sylvia. And then I look over, and there is John, all decked out in a full-length set of pale blue long underwear. He is smirking from ear to ear at how silly he looks. I stare at his glasses lying on the table for a moment, and then say to Sylvia, "You know, just a moment ago we were sitting here talking to Clark Kent. See, there's his glasses. And now, all of a sudden, Lois, do you suppose..." John howls, "Chicken man!" He glides over the varnished lobby floor like a skater, does a handspring, then glides back. He raises 1 arm over his head, and then crouches as if starting for the sky. "I'm ready. Here I go." He shakes his head sadly. Geez, I hate to bust through that nice ceiling, but my X-ray vision tells me somebody's in trouble. Chris is giggling. We'll all be in trouble if you don't get some clothes on, Sylvia says. John laughs. An exposer, hey? The Ellendale Revealer. He struts around some more, then begins to put his clothes on over the underwear. He says, oh no, they wouldn't do that. Chicken Man and the police have an understanding. They know who's on the side of law and order and justice and decency and fair play for everyone. When we hit the highway again, it is still chilly, but not like it was. We pass through a number of towns, and gradually, almost imperceptibly, the sun warms us up, and my feelings warm up with it. The tired feeling wears off completely, and the wind and sun feel good now, making it real. It's happening just from the warming of the sun, the road and green prairie farmland and buffeting wind coming together. And soon it is nothing but beautiful warmth and wind and speed and sun down the empty road. The last chills of the morning are thawed by the warm air. Wind and more sun and more smooth road. So green this summer and so fresh. There are white and gold daisies along the grass in front of an old wire fence, a meadow with some cows, and far in the distance, a low rising of the land with something golden on it. Hard to know what it is. No need to know. Where there is a slight rise in the road, the drone of the motor becomes heavier. We top the rise, see a new spread of land before us, the road descends, and the drone of the engine falls away again. Prairie. Tranquil and detached. Later, when we stop, Sylvia has tears in her eyes from the wind, and she stretches out her arms and says, "It's so beautiful. It's so empty." I show Chris how to spread his jacket on the ground and use an extra shirt for a pillow. He is not at all sleepy, but I tell him to lie down anyway. He'll need the rest. I open up my own jacket to soak up more heat. John gets his camera out. After a while, he says, "This is the hardest stuff in the world to photograph. You need a 360-degree lens or something. You see it, and then you look down in the ground glass, and it's just nothing. As soon as you put a border on it, it's gone." I say, "That's what you don't see in a car, I suppose." Sylvia says, "Once when I was about 10, we stopped like this by the road, and I used half a roll of film taking pictures. And when the pictures came back, I cried. There wasn't anything there." "When are we going to get going?" Chris says. "What's your hurry?" I ask. "I just want to get going." "There's nothing up ahead that's any better than it is right here." He looks down silently with a frown. "Are we going to go camping tonight?" he asks. The Sutherlands look at me apprehensively. "Are we?" he repeats. "We'll see later," I say. "Why later?" "Because I don't know now."
"Why don't you know now?"
"Well, I just don't know now why I just don't know." John shrugs that it's okay. "This isn't the best camping country," I say. "There's no cover and no water." But suddenly I add, "All right, tonight we'll camp out." We had talked about it before. So we move down the empty road. I don't want to own these prairies, or photograph them, or change them, or even stop, or even keep going. We are just moving down the empty road. Chapter 5. The flatness of the prairie disappears, and a deep undulation of the earth begins. Fences are rarer, and the greenness has become paler, all signs that we approach the high plains. We stop for gas at Haig, and ask if there is any way to get across the Missouri between Bismarck and Mobridge. The attendant doesn't know of any. It is hot now, and John and Sylvia go somewhere to get their long underwear off. The motorcycle gets a change of oil and chain lubrication. Chris watches everything I do, but with some impatience. Not a good sign. "My eyes hurt," he says. "From what?" "From the wind." "We'll look for some goggles." All of us go in a shop for coffee and rolls. Everything is different except one another. So we look around rather than talk, catching fragments of conversation among people who seem to know each other, and are glancing at us because we're new. Afterward, down the street, I find a thermometer for storage in the saddlebags and some plastic goggles for Chris. The hardware man doesn't know any short route across the Missouri either. John and I study the map. I had hoped we might find an unofficial ferry boat crossing or footbridge or something in the 90-mile stretch. But evidently there isn't any because there's not much to get to on the other side. It's all Indian reservation. We decide to head south to Mobridge and cross there. The road south is awful. Choppy, narrow, bumpy concrete with a bad headwind. Going into the sun and big semis going the other way. These roller coaster hills speed them up on the downside and slow them up on the upside, and prevent our seeing very far ahead, making passing nerve-wracking. The first one gave me a scare because I wasn't ready for it. Now I hold tight and brace for them. No danger, just a shockwave that hits you. It's hotter and drier. At Hair-Eyed, John disappears for a drink while Sylvia and Chris and I find some shade in a park and try to rest. It isn't restful. A change has taken place, and I don't know quite what it is. The streets of this town are broad, much broader than they need be, and there is a pallor of dust in the air. Empty lots here and there between the buildings have weeds growing in them. The sheet metal equipment sheds and water tower are like those of previous towns, but more spread out. Everything is more run down and mechanical looking, and sort of randomly located. Gradually, I see what it is. Nobody is concerned anymore about tidily conserving space. The land isn't valuable anymore. We are in a western town. We have lunch of hamburgers and malteds at an A&W place in Mobridge, cruise down a heavily trafficked main street, and then there it is at the bottom of the hill, the Missouri. All that moving water is strange, banked by grass hills that hardly get any water at all. I turn around and glance at Chris, but he doesn't seem to be particularly interested in it. We coast down the hill, clunk onto the bridge, and across we go, watching the river through the girders moving by rhythmically, and then we are on the other side. We climb a long, long hill into another kind of country. The fences are really all gone now. No brush, no trees. The sweep of the hills is so great, John's motorcycle looks like an ant up ahead moving through the green slopes. Above the slopes, outcroppings of rocks stand out overhead at the tops of the bluffs. It all has a natural tidiness. If it were abandoned land, there would be a chewed-up, scruffy look, with chunks of old foundation concrete, scraps of painted sheet metal and wire, weeds that had gotten in where the sod was broken up for whatever little enterprise was attempted. None of that here. Not kept up, just never messed up in the first place. It's just the way it always must have been. Reservation land. There's no friendly motorcycle mechanic on the other side of those rocks, and I'm wondering if we're ready for this. If anything goes wrong now, we're in real trouble. I check the engine temperature with my hand. It's reassuringly cool. I put in the clutch and let it coast for a second in order to hear it idling. Something sounds funny, and I do it again. It takes a while to figure out that it's not the engine at all. There's an echo from the bluff ahead that lingers after the throttle is closed. Funny. I do this two or three times. Chris wonders what's wrong, and I have him listen to the echo. No comment from him. This old engine has a nickels and dimes sound to it, as if there were a lot of loose change flying around inside. Sounds awful, but it's just normal valve clatter. Once you get used to that sound and learn to expect it, you automatically hear any difference. If you don't hear any, that's good. I tried to get John interested in that sound once, but it was hopeless. All he heard was noise, and all he saw was the machine and me with greasy tools in my hands. Nothing else. That didn't work. He didn't really see what was going on and was not interested enough to find out. He isn't so interested in what things mean as in what they are. That's quite important, that he sees things this way. It took me a long time to see this difference, and it's important for the Chautauqua that I make this difference clear. I was so baffled by his refusal even to think about any mechanical subject, I kept searching for ways to clue him to the whole thing, but didn't know where to start. I thought I would wait until something went wrong with his machine, and then I would help him fix it, and that way get him into it. But I goofed that one myself because I didn't understand this difference in the way he looked at things. His handlebars had started slipping. Not badly, he said. Just a little when you shoved hard on them. I warned him not to use his adjustable wrench on the tightening nuts. It was likely to damage the chrome and start small rust spots. He agreed to use my metric sockets and box ends. When he brought his motorcycle over, I got my wrenches out, but then noticed that no amount of tightening would stop the slippage because the ends of the collars were pinched shut. "You're going to have to shim those out," I said. "What's shim?" "It's a thin, flat strip of metal. You just slip it around the handlebar under the collar there, and it will open up the collar to where you can tighten it again. You use shims like that to make adjustments in all kinds of machines." "Oh," he said. He was getting interested. "Good. Where do you buy them?" "I got some right here," I said gleefully, holding up a can of beer in my hand. He didn't understand for a moment. Then he said,
"What? The can?"
"Sure," I said. "Best shim stock in the world." I thought this was pretty clever myself. Save him a trip to God knows where to get shim stock. Save him time, save him money. But to my surprise, he didn't see the cleverness of this at all. In fact, he got noticeably haughty about the whole thing. Pretty soon he was dodging and filling with all kinds of excuses, and before I realized what his real attitude was, we had decided not to fix the handlebars after all. As far as I know, those handlebars are still loose. And I believe now that he was actually offended at the time. I had had the nerve to propose repair of his new $1,800 BMW, the pride of a half century of German mechanical finesse, with a piece of old beer can. Ach du lieber! Since then, we have had very few conversations about motorcycle maintenance. None, now that I think of it. You push it any further, and suddenly you are angry without knowing why. I should say, to explain this, that beer can aluminum is soft and sticky, as metals go, perfect for the application. Aluminum doesn't oxidize in wet weather, or, more precisely, it always has a thin layer of oxide that prevents any further oxidation, also perfect. In other words, any true German mechanic, with a half century of mechanical finesse behind him, would have concluded that this particular solution to this particular technical problem was perfect. For a while I thought what I should have done was sneak over to the workbench, cut a shim from the beer can, remove the printing, and then come back and tell him we were in luck. It was the last one I had, specially imported from Germany. That would have done it. A special shim from the private stock of Baron Alfred Krupp, who had to sell it at a great sacrifice. Then he would have gone gaga over it. That Krupp's private shim fantasy gratified me for a while, but then it wore off and I saw it was just being vindictive. In its place grew that old feeling I've talked about before, a feeling that there's something bigger involved than is apparent on the surface. You follow these little discrepancies long enough and they sometimes open up into huge revelations. There was just a feeling on my part that this was something a little bigger than I wanted to take on without thinking about it, and I turned instead to my usual habit of trying to extract causes and effects to see what was involved that could possibly lead to such an impasse between John's view of that lovely shim and my own. This comes up all the time in mechanical work, a hang-up. You just sit and stare and think and search randomly for new information and go away and come back again, and after a while the unseen factors start to emerge. What emerged in vague form at first and then in sharper outline was the explanation that I had been seeing that shim in a kind of intellectual, rational, cerebral way in which the scientific properties of the metal were all that counted. John was going at it immediately and intuitively, grooving on it. I was going at it in terms of underlying form. He was going at it in terms of immediate appearance. I was seeing what the shim meant. He was seeing what the shim was. That's how I arrived at that distinction. And when you see what the shim is, in this case, it's depressing. Who likes to think of a beautiful precision machine fixed with an old hunk of junk? I guess I forgot to mention John is a musician, a drummer who works with groups all over town and makes a pretty fair income from it. I suppose he just thinks about everything the way he thinks about drumming, which is to say he doesn't really think about it at all. He just does it. Is with it. He just responded to fixing his motorcycle with a beer can the way he would respond to someone dragging the beat while he was playing. It just did a big thud with him, and that was it. He didn't want any part of it. At first, this difference seemed fairly minor, But then it grew, and grew, and grew, until I began to see why I missed it. Some things you miss because they're so tiny you overlook them, but some things you don't see because they're so huge. We were both looking at the same thing, seeing the same thing, talking about the same thing, thinking about the same thing, except he was looking, seeing, talking, and thinking from a completely different dimension. He really does care about technology. It's just that in this other dimension, he gets all screwed up and is rebuffed by it. It just won't swing for him. He tries to swing it without any rational premeditation, and botches it and botches it and botches it, and after so many botches, gives up and just kind of puts a blanket curse on that whole nuts and bolts scene. He will not or cannot believe there is anything in this world for which grooving is not the way to go. That's the dimension he's in, the groovy dimension. I'm being awfully square talking about all this mechanical stuff all the time. It's all just parts and relationships and analyses and syntheses and figuring things out. And it isn't really here. It's somewhere else, which thinks it's here, but's a million miles away. This is what it's all about. He's on this dimensional difference, which underlay much of the cultural changes of the 60s, I think, and is still in the process of reshaping our whole national outlook on things. The generation gap has been a result of it. The names Beat and Hip grew out of it. Now it's become apparent that this dimension isn't a fad that's going to go away next year or the year after. It's here to stay because it's a very serious and important way of looking at things that looks incompatible with reason and order and responsibility, but actually is not. Now we are down to the root of things. My legs have become so stiff they are aching. I held them out one at a time and turned my foot as far to the left and to the right as it will go to stretch the leg. It helps, but then the other muscles get tired from holding the legs out. What we have here is a conflict of visions of reality. The world as you see it right here, right now, is reality, regardless of what the scientists say it might be. That's the way John sees it. But the world as revealed by its scientific discoveries is also reality, regardless of how it may appear. And people in John's dimension are going to have to do more than just ignore it if they want to hang on to their vision of reality. John will discover this if his points burn out. That's really why he got upset that day when he couldn't get his engine started. It was an intrusion on his reality. It just blew a hole right through his whole groovy way of looking at things, and he would not face up to it because it seemed to threaten his whole lifestyle. In a way, he was experiencing the same sort of anger scientific people have sometimes about abstract art, or at least used to have. That didn't fit their lifestyle either. What you've got here really are two realities, one of immediate artistic appearance and one of underlying scientific explanation. And they don't match, and they don't fit, and they don't really have much of anything to do with one another. That's quite a situation. You might say there's a little problem here. At one stretch in the long, desolate road, we see an isolated grocery store. Inside and back, we find a place to sit on some packing cases and drink canned beer. The fatigue and backache are getting to me now. I push the packing case over to a post and lean on that. Chris's expression shows he is really settling into something bad. This has been a long, hard day. I told Sylvia way back in Minnesota that we could expect a slump in spirits like this on the second or third day, and now it's here. Minnesota? When was that? A woman, badly drunk, is buying beer for some man she's got outside in a car. She can't make up her mind what brand to buy, and the wife of the owner waiting on her is getting mad. She still can't decide, but then sees us and weaves over and asks if we own the motorcycles. We nod yes. Then she wants a ride on one. I move back and let John handle this. He puts her off graciously, but she comes back again and again, offering him a dollar for a ride. I make some jokes about it, but they're not funny and just add to the depression. We get out and back into the brown hills and heat again. By the time we reach Lemon, we are really aching tired. At a bar, we hear about a campground to the south. John wants to camp in a park in the middle of Lemon, a comment that sounds strange and angers Chris greatly. I'm more tired now than I can remember having been in a long time. The others, too. But we drag ourselves through a supermarket, pick up whatever groceries come to mind, and with some difficulty, pack them onto the cycles. The sun is so far down, we're running out of light. It'll be dark in an hour. We can't seem to get moving. I wonder, are we dawdling or what? Come on, Chris, let's go, I say.
Don't holler at me, I'm ready.
We drive down a county road from Lemon, exhausted for what seems a long, long time, but can't be too long because the sun is still above the horizon. The campsite is deserted. Good. But there is less than a half hour of sun and no energy left. This is the hardest now. I try to get unpacked as fast as possible, but am so stupid with exhaustion I just set everything by the camp road without seeing what a bad spot it is. Then I see it is too windy. This is a high plains wind. It is semi-desert here, everything burned up and dry except for a lake, a large reservoir of some sort below us. The wind blows from the horizon across the lake and hits us with sharp gusts. It is already chilly. There are some scrubby pines back from the road about 20 yards, and I ask Chris to move the stuff over there. He doesn't do it. He wanders off down to the reservoir. I carry the gear over by myself. I see between trips that Sylvia is making a real effort at setting things up for cooking, but she's as tired as I am. The sun goes down. John has gathered wood, but it's too big and the wind is so gusty it's hard to start. It needs to be splintered into kindling. I go back over to the scrub pines, hunt around through the twilight for the machete, but it's already so dark in the pines I can't find it. I need the flashlight. I look for it, but it's too dark to find that either. I go back and start up the cycle, and ride it back over to shine the headlight on the stuff so I can find the flashlight. I look through all the stuff item by item to find the flashlight. It takes a long time to realize I don't need the flashlight. I need the machete, which is in plain sight. By the time I get it back, John has got the fire going. I use the machete to hack up some of the larger pieces of wood. Chris reappears. He's got the flashlight.
When are we going to eat?
He complains. We're getting it fixed as fast as possible, I tell him. Leave the flashlight here. He disappears again, taking the flashlight with him. The wind blows the fire so hard it doesn't reach up to cook the steaks. We try to fix up a shelter from the wind, using large stones from the road. But it's too dark to see what we're doing. We bring both cycles over and catch the scene in a crossbeam of headlights. Peculiar light. Bits of ash blowing up from the fire suddenly glow bright white in it, then disappear in the wind. Bang! There's a loud explosion behind us. Then I hear Chris giggling. Sylvia is upset.
I found some firecrackers, Chris says.
I catch my anger in time and say to him coldly, it's time to eat now.
I need some matches, he says.
Sit down and eat.
Give me some matches first.
Sit down and eat. He sits down and I try to eat the steak with my army mess knife, but it is too tough, and so I get out a hunting knife and use it instead. The light from the motorcycle headlight is full upon me so that the knife, when it goes down into the mess gear, is in full shadow, and I can't see where it's going. Chris says he can't cut his either, and I pass my knife to him. While reaching for it, he dumps everything onto the tarp. No one says a word. I'm not angry that he spilled it. I'm angry that now the tarp's going to be greasy the rest of the trip.
Is there any more?
He asks. Eat that, I say. It just fell on the tarp.
It's too dirty, he says.
Well, that's all there is. A wave of depression hits. I just want to go to sleep now. But he's angry, and I expect we're going to have one of his little scenes. I wait for it, and pretty soon it starts.
I don't like the taste of this, he says.
Yes, that's rough, Chris.
I don't like any of this. I don't like this camping at all.
It was your idea, Sylvia says. You're the one who wanted to go camping. She shouldn't say that, but there's no way she can know. You can take his bait and he'll feed you another one, and then another, and another, until you finally hit him, which is what he really wants.
I don't care, he says.
Well, you ought to, she says. Well, I don't.
An explosion point is very near. Sylvia and John look at me, but I remain deadpan. I'm sorry about this, but there's nothing I can do right now. Any argument will just worsen things.
I'm not hungry, Chris says.
No one answers.
My stomach hurts, he says.
The explosion is avoided when Chris turns and walks away in the darkness. We finish eating. I help Sylvia clean up, and then we sit around for a while. We turn the cycle lights off to conserve the batteries, and because the light from them is ugly anyway. The wind has died down some, and there is a little light from the fire. After a while, my eyes become accustomed to it. The food and anger have taken off some of the sleepiness. Chris doesn't return.
Do you suppose he's just punishing? Sylvia asks.
I suppose, I say, although it doesn't sound quite right. I think about it and add, that's a child psychology term, a context I dislike. Let's just say he's being a complete bastard. John laughs a little. Anyway, I say, it was a good supper. I'm sorry he had to act up like this.
Oh, that's all right, John says.
I'm just sorry he won't get anything to eat. It won't hurt him. You don't suppose he'll get lost out there?
No.
He'll holler if he is. Now that he is gone and we have nothing to do, I become more aware of the space all around us. There is not a sound anywhere. Lone prairie. Sylvia says,
do you suppose he really has stomach pains?
Yes, I say, somewhat dogmatically. I'm sorry to see the subject continued, but they deserve a better explanation than they're getting. They probably sense that there's more to it than they've heard. I'm sure he does, I finally say. He's been examined a half dozen times for it. Once it was so bad we thought it was appendicitis. I remember we were on a vacation up north. I just finished getting out an engineering proposal for a $5 million contract that just about did me in. That's a whole other world. No time and no patience and 600 pages of information to get out the door in 1 week, and I was about ready to kill 3 different people, and we thought we'd better head for the woods for a while. I can hardly remember what part of the woods we were in. Head just spinning with engineering data. And anyway, Chris was just screaming. We couldn't touch him, until I finally saw I was going to have to pick him up fast and get him to the hospital. And where that was, I'll never remember. But they found nothing.
Nothing?
Nope. But it happened again on other occasions, too.
Don't they have any idea? Sylvia asks.
This spring they diagnosed it as the beginning symptoms of mental illness.
What?
John says. It's too dark to see Sylvia or John now, or even the outlines of the hills. I listen for sounds in the distance, but hear none. I don't know what to answer, and so say nothing. When I look hard, I can make out stars overhead, but the fire in front of us makes it hard to see them. The night all around is thick and obscure. My cigarette is down to my fingers, and I put it out.
I didn't know that, Sylvia's voice says.
All traces of anger are gone.
We wondered why you brought him instead of your wife, she says. I'm glad you told us.
John shoves some of the unburned ends of the wood into the fire.
Sylvia says, what do you suppose the cause is?
John's voice rasps, as if to cut it off, but I answer, I don't know. Causes and effects don't seem to fit. Causes and effects are a result of thought. I would think mental illness comes before thought. This doesn't make sense to them, I'm sure. It doesn't make much sense to me, and I'm too tired to try to think it out and give it up.
What do the psychiatrists think? John asks.
Nothing. I stopped it.
Stopped it?
Yes.
Is that good?
I don't know. There's no rational reason I can think of for saying it's not good. Just a mental block of my own. I think about it and all the good reasons for it, and make plans for an appointment and even look for the phone number, and then the block hits and it's just like a door slammed shut. That doesn't sound right. No one else thinks so either. I suppose I can't hold out forever.
But why? Sylvia asks.
I don't know why. It's just that, I don't know. They're not kin. Surprising word, I think to myself.